Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we look at high injury rates at the Fresno Amazon Fulfillment Center. And a filmmaker documents the small town of Tooleyville's struggle for clean drinking water. We also meet the new CEO of the Fresno Economic Opportunities Commission, one of the Valley's largest nonprofit organizations. But first, we're going to start in Bakersfield, where the city has just approved plans for a new emergency low-barrier homeless shelter. Like many places in California, Bakersfield is struggling with a large and growing homeless population. But as Christina Lopez reports, community reaction to the placement of the shelter is mixed.
Mike Walford has been living in East Bakersfield for 60 years. He says the city always tries to dump unwanted facilities in this part of town, a sewage treatment plant, a dog pound, he says, and now a homeless shelter.
They bring all the trash out there. We're tired of taking it. Take it out in the Rosedale, the Hagen Oaks, they don't want it. I don't want it either.
Rosedale and Hagen Oaks are more affluent communities where there are no homeless shelters. Once this new shelter is built in an empty office complex and warehouse owned by cotton manufacturer Calcott, East Bakersfield will have two homeless shelters. Walford, who made his comments at a public meeting, says this part of the city needs better infrastructure, not more shelters.
You should work with the county. They already got some places to go. That would save money for everybody. We got enough problems.
Walford thinks the city should have just worked with the county to improve an existing shelter downtown. The city says it will improve the neighborhood surrounding the new facility with sidewalks, gutters, and streetlights. The site for the 70,000-square-foot shelter is about a mile from Valley Bible Fellowship, a megachurch on East Brundage Lane. Youth Minister Justin Greer says he questions the benefit of the $7 million facility.
I think Bakersfield is acting too quickly in spending these millions on a facility that we do not know is going to work.
Greer says he's concerned the shelter will just create problems for the community he serves.
What I think it's going to do is just hoard more homeless people. And for the community I'm in, I believe that's going to bring more violence, it's going to bring more theft, it's going to bring a lot of things.
Absolutely nobody wants homeless people close to them.
That's Lewis Gill. He's the CEO of the Bakersfield Homeless Center, which is also in East Bakersfield. People are afraid of living near a homeless shelter, he says. His center allows walk-ups, but the new shelter will be referral only.
You don't have individuals with all of their possessions traveling blocks and blocks trying to get there. Instead, you can give them a ride in a van, bring their things, and then you can limit some of the, we'll call it, discomfort that the neighbors would express.
The new shelter will include dorms, pet kennels, office space for service providers, and even a 15,000-square-foot Bakersfield Police Department substation. One of his main concerns is the limited number of beds.
It is a very large facility, and I would struggle with believing that the city council members would feel comfortable with the size of investment necessary for just 150 beds.
The city says it will open the shelter with 150 beds and may reevaluate the need for more beds in the future. Gill says more beds are necessary. He drives me by several homeless encampments that are close to the center he runs.
What you can see on the right-of-way for the railroad tracks are many, many encampments. Individuals, of course, are using the trees and other natural terrain that's been planted along that right-of-way.
The side of the railroad tracks is peppered with blue-colored tarps and various tents.
And so who's living in these encampments right here? Is this a specific demographic or is all kinds of people?
You'll find single adults, you'll find couples, from senior citizens to young individuals that have just come out of foster care to have had their first real mental health issue that their family just couldn't deal with.
It's impossible, Gill says, for people to have good hygiene in places like these.
There just aren't bathrooms. And a body does what a body does. And then what do you do when that builds up? Then there's just refuse from food. And so that attracts rodents, rats, and you have other problems that come with that.
The Bakersfield Homeless Center has 174 beds, but on most nights, at least 200 people show up. One of the center's residents, Mark Wilkins, says he's relieved to have a place to stay. On this day, he's sifting through a donation pile.
They've got shirts, there's underwear, they've got tennis shoes, they've got bedding.
Wilkins, a 59-year-old Army veteran, says he used to wash windows for a living, but the work dried up.
People started wanting to do their own windows, and then 2 weeks later, you know, they say they don't have the money, and then 2 weeks later, they're buying brand new cars. You know, they'd rather have a car than have their business windows clean.
Before he got a bed at the homeless center, he lived on the streets downtown. For nearly a month, he slept on a short metal bench.
A little short for me, so I had to have my feet bent the whole night, but I managed. I had a blanket. I didn't have a pillow, so I used my backpack.
Now Wilkins has a place to stay until he finds a permanent home. City says it plans to open the new shelter in the fall of 2020. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Christina Lopez in Bakersfield.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. 2.5 months ago, 4 members of the Hmong community died in a mass shooting in Fresno. As the victims' loved ones continue to process their feelings of anger and loss, the Fresno Center has provided counseling and support programs. Now it's expanding its efforts, thanks to an $80,000 grant from Kaiser Permanente. I spoke with psychologist Dr. Gia Zhang from the Fresno Center, along with licensed marriage and family therapist Anna Boydston from Kaiser Permanente, about the ongoing work to help the community heal. Dr. Zhang, I'd like to start with you.
Yes, sure.
There's a stigma associated with mental health across many communities. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how does that stigma manifest in the Southeast Asian community?
Well, mental health stigma in our community is a really big thing, to the point where it's across generations as well, too, and to the point where we don't really have a word for mental health, and we just have to describe the symptoms that are associated with mental health. Mm. And anyone that you come in contact with, you work with that, you know, has mental health, other people around it will kind of just want to back away from that. Mm. That is something that in our culture, for whatever reason, people have not had the opportunity to really work with such individuals and really to study, to know really what's going on. And so that's the reason why there's that big old stigma in our community.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, what do you see in terms of the stigma in addressing these issues?
Yes, thank you. So I do believe that the stigma is still very, very present and very much something we still have to tackle and address, you know, as a community and as providers. You know, having worked with different populations and communities, this stigma is not certainly just something that affects the Southeast Asian community, but just other cultures and communities, and unfortunately it does still pose as a barrier for obtaining services, being open to services, and again just that confusion and misconception about what we do and how we can help as providers and professionals. So the education and the outreach, I think, is definitely something that we still need to provide and look at. However we can do that, and whatever means we can provide that.
We know that the Hmong community in general is in the aftermath of an absolutely horrific, tragic event. Dr. Zhang, can you speak to how the community is coping, how they're managing, and the work that you're doing to help?
Yes. First of all, I do want to thank the Valley Public Radio for allowing the Fresno Center for this opportunity to share about our plans to help address this mass shooting in the community. I also wanted to thank Kaiser Permanente of Northern California and their foundations for supporting this effort. This is a tremendous and very big task, and with such a very diverse community like Fresno. But we understand that every little things that we do definitely will help keep our community safer and make Fresno a better place for us to call home. Also, I wanted to thank the community leaders, the community, our law enforcement, DAs, our elected officials, and anyone who contributed their time, their thinking, love, and financial to giving these victims' family the support, and also for really getting these people who caused this and bring them to justice. So just on behalf of the organization, the Hmong community, I wanted to thank everyone for that. Like I said, the Fresno Center is a nonprofit organization that started to serve, the refugee originally who first came here in the early 1980s into the 1991s. And then later now we have evolved to being able to serve a larger community, those who are underserved and unserved in a variety of capacities. And so our mission really is to assist individuals in becoming self-sufficient, self-fulfilled, and productive members of the community while fostering cultural preservation and promoting cross-cultural understanding. And so the purpose of our grant with the Kaiser Foundation is mainly twofold. One is to provide support in the form of assistance, linkages, consultations, and direct mental health services to the victims and their loved ones. And at the same time, what we hope to do is to educate our community at large about mass shooting through community events and also workshops.
Mm-hmm. So I feel silly asking this question because grief is so individual and it's so difficult to generalize. That being said, can you speak to how the community is doing and the extent to which they are engaging with you and taking advantage of these resources?
Yes. And so for us at the Fresno Center, we have professional bilingual, bicultural mental health clinicians like psychiatrists, psychologists, other licensed mental health professionals, counselors, and case managers that have been providing needed mental health services at our Living Well Center to support all the victim families. So imagine your family escaping death from the Vietnam War, then to survive swimming on bamboo raft and tire tubes across the largest river in Southeast Asia, and then to escape illnesses in the refugee camps, and then to only be murdered while enjoying a great time watching Sunday night football with all of your friends and loved ones, right? Mm-hmm. So many of these families and everyone, they're saying, how can this be? This is not right. This is not fair. Mm-hmm. If I knew this was going to happen, I should have done something more heroic and die, like protecting people during the Vietnam War or swimming, saving someone crossing the Mekong River. This is the kind of anger, the frustration, something that they don't really understand what's going on. Why in America that this is happening? We have gone through much worse thing, the Vietnam War, all of this stuff, than to just, on a quiet day, to just then have this happen. So it not only impact just the family, the community, and the Hmong community, but I think the whole larger community as a whole, and eventually also across the United States when it goes on national news and stuff like that. So, yes, it has a very tragic and traumatic impact on the community, and it'll take a while for everyone to be able to recover from it. And even if they recover from it, there's always still going to be a scar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anna, can you speak to what I would imagine is a unique part of the grief process when you lose a loved one in such a shocking way, in such a tragic way as the victims of the mass shooting in November did?
Yes. I would just like to start by again thanking Dr. Zhang for just educating us and informing us about Fresno Center's mission and goals, and Kaiser is definitely in support of that, and for that perspective as well of what that impact must have been like, for the families that were simply enjoying themselves at an event and have this shocking, tragic incident happen. Having said that, I think it is important for us to be aware of the different things that could start to happen to the families and the individuals that were present for that event or that lost a loved one. You speak specifically, to grief, wondering what that could bring up. If we're speaking specifically about children and adolescents, you know, things that we want to be kind of aware of and looking for are going to be those significant changes in emotional and behavioral functioning. You know, we have to also remember that shock that Dr. Zhang talked about and that you mentioned might not play out right away after an incident like this. This might sometimes play out days or weeks or even months later. And again, it's important for us not to overlook, you know, and I think what could possibly happen in some cases is if we don't see that drastic change right away, perhaps in our mind we might think, oh, okay, everything's okay. Then you know, we can move forward. But just to be aware that we might see some of those emotional and behavioral changes. Could grief can come in the forms of depression, anger, significant levels of anxiety. You might start seeing changes in school functioning, grades going down, nightmares, just to name a few, you know. And for many of us, children and adults, grief isn't always something easy to talk about. And so there could be for some of these individuals just the nature of holding it within and not releasing or sharing that and which that in and of itself can cause further distress, just not having, you know, feeling that you have an outlet to share or process those feelings. And for adults, you know, a lot of those symptoms and things that I bring up as things that can occur from grief can also be very present for adults as well. Some of those changes, perhaps, you know, in our work that we do, just personally, how we interact, you know, grief can affect us in many ways, and as can shock. Mm-hmm. So,
absolutely, yeah. Yes.
And then in working with all these families, we see this grief cycle, right? We see a lot of people being in denial, mm-hmm. right? And being angry, having bargain, mm-hmm. to the point where many of them now moving on to other stages like depression. And when is it that we will be able to help them to really get to that last stage of acceptance? Mm-hmm. And so for the adults and for all of the children's, all these different stages, they're going back and forth asking why. Why? Mm-hmm. Right? And why is it me? What did I do wrong? Mm-hmm. Right? And so all this anger and denial eventually turned into this depression, mm-hmm. and our job is really to be able to work with the families and hopefully get to this stage of acceptance.
Mm-hmm. What does that work look like? And I'll open up this question. What are the kind of resources that are being offered?
Wonderful.
Yes, at the center, like I said before, we have a variety of professionals, all the way from medical doctors to your caseworkers, that are providing supportive services, linkage, whatever they need. It is our job to be able to link them to it or to provide that service. If they need direct mental health service, if they need medications, you have a Hmong psychiatrist that will be able to sit down with them and say, let me try to understand beyond what you're telling me what's going on. You have a psychologist who could sit there, and if assessments are needed, we'll be able to assess that. And then you have licensed mental health clinicians who speaks their language that could sit down with them and listen empathetically and genuinely and being present and then hoping that then we can help them to move on to the next stage, to make them realize that this kind of things just doesn't happen to them. It could happen to anybody, and that you have to see the bigger picture.
And then, Anna, I understand that the grant also is helping to fund wellness classes, meditation, yoga, other practices that could be of value in supporting this process.
Absolutely. And you know, Kaiser definitely wants to be part of the support network for the community. And you know, quite frankly, this event has affected not only the Southeast Asian community, but Fresno as a whole, as a greater area, has been impacted by this.
So. Are you hearing from people? Are they coming to you talking about this event? I mean, it sent such shockwaves through the entire community.
Absolutely. You know, it definitely is something that I think is marked in our memory of a recent tragic event. I think as the timing as well of not that there's any time that would be better or worse, but the timing of it, you know, coming right around the holidays, right around the time when families get together, mm-hmm. celebrate, practice traditions. The impact has definitely been strong, you know, around those immediate following, you know, days and weeks. And I think, you know, now the impact at whatever stage it is still just finding a way to connect with the folks and to provide outreach and to encourage, you know, families and individuals to utilize whatever resources are available. You know, I certainly appreciate the Fresno Center and the rich services that they offer. And again, but it could be something, as you say, yoga, spirituality, mental health. You know, Kaiser has a child and adult psychiatry departments that can serve individuals for individual therapy. We have psychiatric services. Those who choose to go that route and utilize the services, again, I think the most important is that folks are utilizing whatever's helpful to them mm-hmm. to cope and mm-hmm. to come, as Dr. Zhang said, mm-hmm. to some place of acceptance.
Yeah. And on that note, we have a save the date. We have a Fresno Community Healing Sessions that we're planning to have this February 21st and 22nd at Fresno Pacific Universities, where we wanted to invite the community to come in and to just do yoga and have mindfulness sessions and reflections and that kind of stuff. And we're probably going to announce more, but this is really the beginning of how we are helping to heal the community, how we're helping to educate and make the community much more aware of this kind of tragic.
So, Dr. Zhang, you spoke before about the differences between adults and children in processing and coming to acceptance, as you said, with this event, this tragedy. I'm wondering if you could speak among adults about generational differences that you're seeing. Mm-hmm. Are older adults in general processing this or having feelings that maybe are different than what the younger mm-hmm. generation is?
Yes, definitely. I think for the adults, the impact is much more stronger for them, you know, because like I said, of what they have gone through to just then come to witness such a senseless murder like this. Whereas most children, unless you are really the family that's directly impacted, many of the children are really getting a better idea of what's really going out in the community and that it's not really safe and that we need to be more careful. But I think when you're talking to a lot of the adults, this is something that, you know, it's going to just etch in their heart and it's going to be something that's going to be a long time for them to really heal. Mm-hmm. Because in our community, especially in the Hmong community of Southeast Asia, everybody is related to each other in so many different ways. And so once something like this happens, you have this connection from one to another to another and to another.
Hmm. And what are you seeing in the work that you do? I mean, I guess what advice do you have for maybe the people that are listening who are still feeling impacted by the mass shooting or, I mean, my goodness, are going through any kind of personal tragedy that they might be having? There's a lot of conversation about the lack of resources to support mental health healing in the community. It seems like both Kaiser and the Fresno Center are places that are helping to fill in that gap. What would you say to people in terms of how to go about accessing the help that they need?
Thank you. Such an important question. I think the importance is starting with discussions and just being able to talk and identify that there is a need. I think being able to start with whatever's most comfortable, whether that's somebody in the school setting, if it's a child, whether that's, you know, a colleague, a friend, a family, and just start the outreach from there. You know, Fresno, I think, has come a long way as far as mental health outreach and awareness. And I think just the community does offer, you know, events and workshops. Kaiser has a very extensive, as I mentioned, mental health department. You know, again, you know, thinking of the traditions and the cultures, you know, a lot of the services are geared and meant to be, you know, very, very culturally sensitive to meet folks' needs and to help that sense of comfort, you know, to come, you know, to somebody and accept the help, which often can be the hardest step for many folks is just crossing, you know, that barrier of reaching out and asking for help.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for taking the time to be here with us today. Thank you.
Thank
you.
It's
a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. In 1964, Congress passed the Economic Opportunity Act as part of President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty. The act established nearly 900 community action agencies nationwide to address needs in education, employment, health, and living conditions. Today, the largest of these agencies in California is the Fresno Economic Opportunities Commission. Its scope of services is vast, and now for the first time, it's being run by a woman. FM89's news director, Alice Daniel, spoke with the new CEO, Amelia Reyes, who most recently ran First 5 Fresno County.
Amelia, thank you so much for coming in today. A lot of programs fall under the Fresno EOC, from Early Head Start to a sanctuary for homeless and runaway youth. For an outsider, it seems like the EOC does a little bit of everything to tackle community issues. So break it down for us. What falls under the umbrella of the EOC and why?
So I can share with you from my past experience. I used to work in early education and really focusing on children's issues. And what I learned through community input is a child can't thrive without their family thriving, and a family can't thrive unless the community's thriving. And so the exciting thing about Fresno EOC is that it addresses issues starting from the community to the family and to the child. So the array of services is a holistic approach, a family approach, versus an individual silo approach.
So it's more systemic, looking at everything that could affect the child, the family, the community.
Exactly.
So what practices do you use in deciding how to address an issue?
Well, I haven't been with Fresno EOC for that long, but we partnered with them when I worked with First 5 Fresno County. What we really do start off with is actually doing community engagement. We don't know what issues to address unless we hear from the communities specifically. And ultimately, our families and the community are the experts. So we want to utilize their knowledge to really go after and provide the services that are needed for us to address whatever issue it might be.
So you ask the community what services it needs and then try to provide those?
Yes. Yeah, so normally, for example, infant mortality, it's a big issue in the African-American community. The stats are very stark. And what we decided to do at First 5 in partnership with Fresno EOC is really tackle the issue head on and find out why. And so we decided to reach directly to the Black community to see how we can provide services and support them in combating infant mortality.
So you headed up First 5 for several years, mm-hmm. and obviously you worked with the EOC. What is that jump like for you to go from First 5 to the Fresno EOC?
Actually, it was pretty a smooth transition, actually. Last year, for example, we went out to the community to engage parents and caregivers around issues affecting them and their children. And through that process, we engaged over 600 individuals. And what we realized through that engagement is not only are families struggling to find early care and education and under their child's development, they're struggling to meet the basic needs and necessity to even keep the lights on. And so for us, we also realized that they would share stories about just having a safe place to take their kids outside and play. And it just reaffirmed the need of having a systematic approach, a holistic approach. And at First 5, you know, we focus on the first 5 years of life. And the Community Action Agency with Fresno EOC, the job position happened to be open. And for me, I felt like it was a calling. It was a sign that in order to address the issues that are affecting our young children, we really need to partner with our families and the community to have a bigger impact.
So it sounds like the approaches from both of these agencies are very similar. The problems in Fresno are daunting, and you cross one barrier and there's another one in front of you. What keeps you from getting jaded, or what kind of personality do you have to run this organization?
The three things I've always say, you have to have the passion, the commitment, and the love for this community. Born and raised in the Central Valley, specifically out in Mendota, I've seen the challenges and barriers. And unfortunately, the last year when we went out there again, those issues have just gotten worse. And so obviously we need to change the way we're serving our families to really address those issues. And for me, the fact that I'm here and actually am a former alumni, early Head Start and Head Start, and a WIC recipient really demonstrates the kind of impact EOC has in the community. And for me to be the CEO and to lead an agency of this magnitude, to really understand the challenges and barriers and have the passion and commitment, I'm simply honored and humbled just to have the opportunity to do so.
And you grew up in Mendota in a farm worker family. I'm wondering how your childhood experiences inform how you approach the job today.
Well, I worked in the fields one summer, and actually it was the summer before my senior year because I wanted to earn some money so I can go to camp. And going out there, I was going out to go work in the field so I can earn some money to pay for camp. I worked alongside parents, moms, dads, grandparents that were doing that on a day-to-day basis to raise their family. And for me, their hard work and the challenges and barriers that they went through just to even get here to provide for their family gave me motivation to do more and to really reach for the stars and try to do my best to give back.
And you're the first woman to lead the agency during its 54 years in operation. How significant is that for you?
That was has had a significant impact on me and motivation. The fact that I am the first female and actually the first female of color to run this agency is significant period for our community. The fact that our board, our commission recognized that they saw the passion, love, and commitment that I have to run this agency really demonstrated a lot for the community. And understanding the population and the diversity here in the Central Valley, for young girls, even young boys, seeing a woman of color lead an agency like that, like Fresno EOC, just gives them hope. And for me, I'm just trying my best to make them proud so they can have the opportunity to reach for the stars and that they can do it too, if not more.
And what would you say is the biggest challenge that you've gone through?
Oh my goodness. Not only did I grew up in a family that, you know, my parents mostly provided for us working in the fields, going through education. I lost my sister in college, which was a very traumatic experience as well. And however, it helped me understand and appreciate life. And the next challenge, I'm also a mother of a child with special needs. My son was diagnosed with autism at age 3. If you meet him now, he's 18 years old, going to Buchanan High School, getting ready for college. And now my biggest worry for him is to figure out how to pay for college. And for me, there's multiple challenges I've overcome, but that's also those challenges have made me become the person I am today. And I can look back and be grateful for them because it built my resiliency and understanding of the needs our community and families are facing.
Do you find that those challenges have made you more compassionate?
Oh, absolutely. I really do lead from my heart. And I really want to do what's best for all our families in this community. And so going through my own experiences and the challenges I went through raising my son as a single mother of a child with special needs, I can only imagine moms that have multiple children that don't have any education and want to give their child the best possible start. And I truly believe every parent should have all the resources that they need to make sure that their children are thriving.
So what have these first few weeks been like for you? What's a typical day in the life of the head of the Fresno EOC?
Well, I think that because I've only been on the job, this is my second week. Everybody is trying to inform me, keep me up to date with everything that's going on. And so everything, my day has been pretty busy and pretty chaotic, but it varies from, like, for example, today I went to a press conference, this meeting. Later on, I had a meeting with an attorney, and then I had a meeting with the Head Start folks, and now I'm here with you. Mm-hmm. And so it is from one topic to the next, but it's actually, for me, it's pretty exciting.
So I'm curious, what are some of the lesser known problems in Fresno, things that most of us might not think about, but which affect the county drastically?
I think early care and education, quality child care. Child care is very expensive for any parent, and that is where the foundation starts for our children. And so having enough early quality child care settings for all our children, and I mean not just Head Start and preschool programs, I mean even for our infant toddler slots, they need a place to be able to thrive while their parents are working, and they all deserve a quality environment to grow up.
Well, thank you, Amelia Reyes, the new CEO of Fresno's EOC. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In 2018, e-commerce giant Amazon opened a fulfillment center in southwest Fresno. It employs thousands of people and offers better pay and benefits than similar jobs. But an investigation by the Fresno Bee found that its injury rate is double the state average for the warehouse industry. To learn more, FM89's Carrie Klein sat down with Bee reporter Manuela Tobias, who began by describing what this vast warehouse looks like.
There's almost, I think, 10 miles of conveyors.
Wow.
Taking everything. So you see a lot of packages kind of just whirling around on these conveyors going from one area to the next. There's four floors. It's very loud in there. There's a lot of fans and machinery going. You kind of have to talk pretty loudly if you want to be heard. And most people are sort of at their workstations, and they walk a lot, but stationary. So you walk basically three steps to go from a tray to a cubby where you need to place something. So it's a lot of work on your feet, but a lot of them aren't actually walking all that much.
Got it. So it's a fast-paced, relatively physically demanding job, I suppose, depending on, you know, exactly which part of this whole assembly line process people are doing. But so in your reporting, you found an inordinately high injury rate at this Fresno Fulfillment Center. You know, tell me more about that. How many injuries are we talking about over what period of time?
The Fulfillment Center opened in June 2018. And between that date and the end of May 2019, there were 307 injuries and illnesses reported. Most of those were injuries to the back or wrists or ankles, a lot of them from repetitive motions. Mm-hmm. Some of them, though, were a crushed toe. Something heavy fell on someone and, you know, it was a kind of a one-time thing. And the way that we compare those numbers to other warehouses is using 2018 data. So for that, it's the 6 months that we have from June to December 2018. And basically the way that you measure that is injuries per hours worked. And that gave us about 12 injuries per 100 workers. Those are serious injuries that required time off the job or a change in role at Amazon. So 12 injuries per 100 workers is nearly three times the national warehouse industry average. And it's over double the statewide industry average. The statewide average is about five.
Wow.
We had 12. Within Amazon warehouses, we were also able to rank Fresno's fulfillment center using data from Reveal. They collected data on 28 different warehouses, and we rank 10th there. And within the California warehouses, we rank third.
And that's 28 of these Amazon fulfillment centers around the U.S., you're saying?
Yes.
We're 10th
nationwide.
Among all of those nationwide. Wow. So that's pretty huge.
There's a lot more, though. We just didn't have the records for all of those fulfillment centers.
Yeah. Where did this data come from?
So the data came from Reveal reporting networks. They gathered this data by, first they tried to request it from the federal government and had no luck. And they're challenging that in court. Hmm. So the way that they got these records is through former and current employees who can request data about injury rates at their warehouses.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
So,
and then they shared them with the journalists at Reveal.
So they got a tip from a worker at the Amazon warehouse. We're not sure who. They requested the data, sent it to Reveal, and then Reveal shared it with all of us. Everyone who wanted to participate in this wanted to get access to that data, got it, and so we were able to share this. So the hope is for new numbers also to get them through current or former employees who request that data. But it's been a challenge to try to get it from OSHA.
And so that's the data side of this reporting. But you actually went out and interviewed a number of employees at this Amazon Fulfillment Center as well. What kinds of accounts were you hearing about either their injuries or kind of what their job entails?
It was kind of a challenge to get workers to go on the record. We talked to over a dozen, and a lot of them were really scared of what it would mean to talk about Amazon. Even former employees who are no longer working there feared what could happen if they shared those experiences. The thing that stuck out the most was the speed at which they had to work.
And I should say before you go on that a number of them did go on the record as well. And you use those, you were able to use those names in your report.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So four workers went on the record. And so that's basically what the story is about, those four experiences. But all of them shared that the pace was really fast. For example, basically moving an item from one place to another had to be done within 5 to 7 seconds. So this is a repetitive motion that keeps happening. One way to sort of contextualize the speed is that people were scared to go to the bathroom. The warehouse, as I said before, is huge. So it obviously depends where you're placed. Amazon told us that there is no limit on how many times somebody can go to the bathroom. People don't get in trouble for it, but that's not really what the workers told us. It seemed that they really were under a lot of pressure to meet their quotas, and that translated into bathroom time.
So tell me more about how Amazon responded to what some of these people were saying and about the data that you're reporting on here.
Yeah, so the data, they didn't dispute it. They told us that they're aggressive about reporting injuries, and that they report everything, even if it's not necessarily work-related. And they believe that others in the industry underreport their injuries. So by reporting everything, they are made to look a little bit worse. But workers told me that they felt discouraged from filing injury reports. That suggests that the numbers are actually an undercount.
Very interesting. And so, you know, the warehouse employees, 2,500 people, close to 1,000 of those are full-time. From what you're seeing and from those that you spoke to for this story, are people souring on working for Amazon? I mean, is this injury rate discouraging people from wanting to work here?
Well, I'm not sure about potential employees, but people who were hurt seem to want to go back. They were frustrated by the process, by the way that they were treated sometimes, but the job was a really good one. The benefits are great, is what they told me. They got excellent coverage for more affordable rates than their partners or at previous jobs.
Like for insurance, things like that?
Yes, for health insurance. And the minimum wage is $15, which is better than the state average, and the state minimum wage, I mean.
Yeah, and one of the women that you interviewed who suffered a wrist injury that forced her to quit, she still said she loved it and it was the best job she'd ever had.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we look forward to following up on this and seeing what happens. Manuela Tobias, a reporter at the Fresno Bee, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And finally, we take you to Tooleyville, a small community in Tulare County where contaminated water has flown from faucets since the 1980s. Tooleyville's struggle for clean water captured the interest of a Bay Area filmmaker who just debuted a documentary short about the town. I spoke to the filmmaker, Casey Beck, along with Ben Cuevas Martinez, a Tooleyville resident who appears in the film. Ben, if you could share with us what it's like to cook, to clean, to live in a home where the water isn't safe to drink.
Well, it's hard. I mean, what good is it to have water if you can't drink it?
And what is the day-to-day routine like? How do you prepare food? How do you...
They supply us with drinking bottled water. And they give us five-gallon buckets, you know, five-gallon jugs every 2 weeks.
And how long has it been that way?
Since I moved in here. Almost 2 years this coming May.
Casey, how did you come to know about Tooleyville and people like Ben, and what was it about the story that attracted you?
Yeah, we first heard about Tooleyville through the Leadership Council, which does work in a lot of different areas around the Central Valley, one of which is water and getting safe drinking water for people. And they had known that we were interested in making a film about water contamination. And when they told us the story of the folks in Tooleyville and how they've been fighting for clean water for so long, we were definitely interested. And Ben and his wife, Yolanda, are two of the more engaged residents. So as soon as we started going to community meetings and city council meetings at Exeter, they were always there. And thankfully willing to talk to us and let us interview them and into their home. And so that's kind of how we came to know them and really feature them in the film.
And in the film, you get into the history of how this problem first came about, which involves rental covenants that led to underinvestment in infrastructure. Can you just briefly provide a little bit of that background?
I actually first learned about this the history of this from Pedro Hernandez, who is an activist in the area and was working for the Leadership Council when we were making the film. And he mentioned in one of the interviews that a lot of this stems from originally from redlining and from forcing people of color to live outside of municipal areas. And he mentioned the 1971 Tulare County plan, which we actually found, and it does denote Tooleyville as at that time an agricultural area or an area for agricultural workers, I should say. Kind of the without saying the coded language there is Latinos. So even as of 50 years ago, the county knew that who was living in Tooleyville, and even as of 50 years ago, had no intention of extending services, including water, et cetera, to that area.
So, Ben, as Casey mentioned, you've been really active and involved with the fight to get clean water. I understand the solution to that is to consolidate Tooleyville's system with Exeter's water system. Can you just give us an update on where that conversation stands?
We're working on it. We have Assemblyman Matos, I believe, and Crocker. We're going to have a meeting this coming Friday. Just, try to get them on, see who can strike a deal and go back to the bargaining table and see what we can go from there.
Because so far the conversation hasn't been productive, I understand.
Yes, we're the last one. They just decided not to take any action, so it would just completely die.
And Casey, you're done with this phase of the film, but the project is something that you would like to continue with. Tell us what the plan is for this project.
Yeah, so what's happening in Tooleyville we consider really to be the tip of the iceberg. There are over 300 communities in across California, primarily in the Central Valley, facing similar issues as Tuleville, contaminated water, but within just a few miles of a larger town that has clean water and are hoping to consolidate with that town. Right now, depending on the levels in each town, some of those areas, the state has the power to mandate a consolidation, but in many, they're in a situation more like Tuleville, where they're just having to go and negotiate and bargain with that town, and it's not a mandate from the state. So we're hoping that this short film that we've just produced and will be releasing will just be part of a bigger story about water contamination across the state, and showing the different ways that people, or the different types of contamination that people are facing, and the different ways that they are organizing in order to get and mobilize and get clean water.
Ben, I believe that some people listening are probably asking themselves why you came to Tuleville, given the situation, and why you stay. And I'm just...
I grew up here. I'm sorry. I grew up here. My sister owns a home just down around the corner from where I bought this. This used to be my sister's house. And, I mean, I grew up here. We didn't have any problems back in the 70s. The water was, unless it wasn't regulated, we never... I didn't know anything that was bad. And when we purchased the home, I was not aware that the water wasn't drinkable until after I moved in. That's, you know, if I would have known, I wouldn't have bought this place.
And why have you chosen to remain? I mean, I imagine it's a complicated decision.
I really can't afford anything else. Me and my daughter were the ones that came up and pitched up whatever we had in order to buy this house. We were living here and there with relatives and stuff. So, yeah, it was hard.
And I'd imagine your experience is shared by many of the other residents of Tuleville.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of people just like us, you know, just barely getting through.
Well, we really appreciate your willingness to share your story with us today. And before we wrap up, Casey, I'd love to hear you share how people could see the film.
Yeah, so we are waiting for distribution. Then the film will come out along with an article written by a reporter, and also with a photo essay about featuring the residents of Tuleville. Right now, they can go to our website, which is thegreatdividedoc.com, and we'll be posting updates and more information there.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you both being on the show.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.